Okay, Erev Tov, welcome to Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, Part 8, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katzel, Ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. And tonight we're discussing Rav Aaron Cutler, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. If the Haredi world in America was built, rebuilt after the Holocaust into the dominant force in American Orthodoxy today, so that dominance is not exclusively, but in large part due to the genius, the force of personality, and the perseverance of Rav Aaron Cutler, the Kletzka Rosh Yeshiva. Another complicated figure. Nothing is simple in life. And usually the greater the person, the greater the brilliance, the more complexities there are. I think I noted here a few months ago, Rabbi Chait used to say, in yeshiva world, used to say, he's called Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky a normal shagon, meaning he was a normal. He was normal. He didn't have some of the eccentricities that come along with genius. He was just a normal genius. Rav Aaron Cutler was a complicated figure in many ways. He escaped the Holocaust in 1941, was instrumental in starting the Lakewood Yeshiva in 1943 with about a dozen students, and hoped, he said, that one day he would have 20 students learning there. A few dozen would be a dream. And now, of course, there are many thousands in the Lakewood system. And it's not just a world center of Torah, but it's a symbol of the revival of Torah in the era after the Holocaust. Of course, by Torah, we mean a certain stream of the Torah world, even a certain stream of Orthodoxy that set a standard for observance of mitzvos and minhagim that's not necessarily mainstream in Jewish history, but really has become a yardstick by which Orthodoxy in many circles is measured. Free people can differ as to whether or not this is an entirely welcome development, but nonetheless, as a symbol, Lakewood is an ideal, but it's also a target. Some swear by it as the paradigm of Judaism, and others as ultimately, in some sense, a distortion of Judaism, somewhat. Like most people, his life was shaped by two forces, but in his case, it really was two negative forces that engendered an uncompromising view of any remnant or suggestion of these forces. One was the Haskalah, the Enlightenment on the one hand, which included thereby a rejection of secular education, higher education, college, Zionism, even Yeshiva University, on the one hand. And the second force, of course, was the Holocaust, which by many accounts, and like many others, he failed to anticipate, barely succeeding in saving his own life, but then dedicating himself heart and soul to rescue efforts during the war. He was passionate. He was acerbic. He was also a Slobodka Talmud, a disciple of the altar. He was very refined and proper, even as he was single-minded in his pursuit of his objectives. During his shiurim, he could be a volcano, erupting in torrents of thought, and occasionally invective said in a nice way. He never walked, he always ran. He spoke quickly, he was excitable. In learning, he was even argumentative, but his insights were remarkable. His appearance wasn't. He always dressed bekavod, but he stood barely 5 feet tall, if that. He was a genius. He was so brilliant that even those who could follow his shiurim for the first 20 minutes were perceived to be on a very high level. After that, it was nearly impossible, and as for most people. And his love for the Jewish people was boundless. And none of this had to be, which makes his story so fascinating. He was orphaned at age 11. He was the only member of his family to remain religious. So how did he effect the Torah revolution in America? How was he able to become this influential Torah personality whose activities and institutions still inspire and challenge us until today? And if you look at the first source in the reader, it's something that he said that really is a tremendous reflection on him as well. So famous Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Tezayin Amud Beis, speaks about the three books that are open on Rosh Hashanah. of Rishom Gemurim, Tzadikim Gemurim, the Beinonim, the holy wicked, holy righteous, and the intermediates. The Gemara continues, Tani Beishami Omrim, Shalosh Kitos Hein L'Yom Adin. There are three groups on the Yom Adin, the Day of Judgment. Rashi says in two, it's the Day of Tchias HaMesim, which is another Day of Judgment. And again, one book of Tzadikim Gemurim, and Rishom Gemurim, and Beinonim as well. The questioner of the Aaron Cutler asked, is why is there a Yom HaDin of Tchias HaMesim? Presumably, the individual experienced the Yom HaDin, every Rosh Hashanah, every Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Death as well. That's the great Yom HaDin. So how is it that a person is judged also on the Day of Tchias HaMesim? So he explained, you see from what Beis Shammai is saying, Shalosh Kitos Hein L'Yom HaDin, that a person's judgment, that is to say, his influence, does not end when he dies. There are people who remain influential for decades and centuries after that. And those whose influence is not for good, they keep paying a price for it. But those whose influence is for good, and that good lingers and endures and affects others for generations and generations, so now you see in the Yom HaDin, there's another judgment. It's a favorable judgment as well. Rav Aaron Cutler was born January 1892, same week, coincidentally, that the Voloshiny Yeshiva closed down. He was born in the town of Sislovich, not far from Minsk. The Russians called it Svislich, so I'm glad they Yiddishized it to Sislovich. Also, by coincidence, the birthplace of Rav Shmuel Belkin. He was a genius. Reportedly, he knew all of Tanakh by heart at age 5. Another source I saw said he knew it at age 7. His father, Rav Shneur Zalman Pinnis, was one of the two Rabbanim of the town of Sislovich. His mother died when he was 3 years old. He was the youngest of 4 children. And his father died when he was 11. And Rav Aaron Cutler went to live temporarily with his uncle, Rav Yitzhak Pinnis, his father's brother, the Minsker Dayan, at age 11. So Sislovich was an industry town, mainly tanneries, meaning had a lot of workers, and it attracted a revolutionary element, especially Bundists, who were fighting for workers' rights, as well as a hardcore of Maskilim. But when he moved to Minsk as an 11-year-old, the pressures were even greater. Minsk was a larger city, 40,000 Jews. It was a hotbed of Haskalah. So his uncle first sent him away to Krynik to learn a yeshiva there to keep him far from his irreligious relatives. He had 2 older brothers, both of whom died relatively young, and one sister, Malko, is a decade older than him, and none of them were religious. So the brothers died young, but she lived a long life. She even outlived him. She was a communist sympathizer, university educated. She taught mathematics in Paris, and she survived the war in Paris, after which Rav Aaron Cutler tracked her down and brought her to America, and she became a professor of mathematics at Columbia, which was no small thing for a woman then. She would lament always that her younger brother, Aaron, could have been one of the greatest mathematicians in the world, and instead he chose to be a kleiner Rosh Yeshiva. She looked down on her. She didn't understand it. So his uncle had to battle with his siblings to keep him on the derech. And when he brought him back from Krynik, he registered him, he was 12 years old then, in what was called the Katzavish Shul. The Katzav is a butcher, the butcher's shul, meaning a kollel run or sponsored by the butchers of the town, in the city in Minsk, where he learned. And it was in the Katzav shul that he befriended a contemporary, just a few months older than him, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, to whom he remained close his entire life, even if their personalities and sometimes their hashkafos differed. Rabbi Yaakov was also the only one of his siblings to remain religious. And he came from a much larger family. So it's hard for us to understand, maybe not, the pressures that existed then. They're precious today as well. Then it was completely different. Because to so many Jews, it was obvious the world was heading towards its perfection. Whether it was communism or socialism or some other ism. and to remain locked in the shtetl where you had so few opportunities for growth, either intellectually or financially, it was a real struggle. So they learned together. They even occasionally played chess together. Rabbi Yaakov's family had moved to Minsk, and so they regularly hosted Aaron Cutler for meals. At age 12, he was sent to Knesset Beis Yitzchak of Slobodka, the yeshiva from which the Alter's Knesset Beis Yisrael was a breakaway. And there in Beis Yitzchak, age 12, he came under the tutelage of the new Rosh Yeshiva there, Reb Baruch Ber Leibovich, the close Talmud of Reb Chaim Brisker. He had his bar mitzvah there, 13 years old, an orphan boy. He had his bar mitzvah alone in Knesset Beis Yitzchak. They had a custom in that yeshiva in Slobodka that if a Talmud came up with a chiddush, he would bang on the table, stand up, and announce the chiddush to everyone. Rav Aaron Cutler, the first day he was there, he banged on the table. Nobody could see him because he was so short. They stood him up on a table. By the third time it happened that morning, he gave a klop to offer a chiddush. They abandoned the custom of public announcements of chiddushim. He wasn't there long. He returned to Minsk in 1905 to the kibbutz of the Katzavish Shul. His genius there was so recognized that the butchers paid him the princely sum of 5 rubles a month, more than twice the 2-ruble monthly stipend that most students received. And he was only 13 years old now. The Katzavish Shtibel had no Rosh Yeshiva. People, usually over 18 years old, would learn there. He was very young to be there. Occasionally, Talmid Chachamim would come and give shiurim, but most of the learning was done on their own. And there weren't many of them, because again, of all the other pressures in Jewish life. Back in Minsk again, from his first round in Slobodka, his relatives again wanted to send him to university, or at least learn Torah and secular studies. And again, his uncle, the Minska Dayan, prevailed upon the siblings to leave him alone. But he recognized the danger was ever present. And in 1905, again, shortly after his bar mitzvah, both Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky were recruited by Rav Reuven Grozovsky to learn in the Alter's Yeshiva in Slobodka, Knesset Beis Yisrael, partly to save both of them from the allures of the Haskalah. And Reb Reuven Grozovsky even secured the funding for them for the 180-mile train ride from Minsk to Slobodka, to a suburb of Kovna, right across the Velaya River. Reb Aaron Cutler learned in Slobodka for 5 years, and he always retained the dignity and the bearing and the pursuit of Midas Tovos of the Slobodka Talmud, his sensitivity was extraordinary. He was very makpid on the cover of others. It pained him to criticize a student, even if that's occasionally the fate of Rosh Yeshiva. So, just to skip ahead for a moment to show you the personality, as a Rosh Yeshiva, he spent too much of his time riding around, being driven around to seek donations, really hours and hours and days chasing after a few dollars. Once a day ended, and he'd collected $5 the entire day. And his student, lamented the personal bizoyon, the waste of time of the Rosh Yeshiva. Here he could be giving shiurim, and instead he's left to scrounge for coins. Rav Aaron Cutler responded, the Gemara says, that a Rebbe goes into Golus for failure to pay proper respect, show proper respect to his Talmidim. And since it happens invariably that a Rebbe can stumble in that, you think you're being constructive in criticizing a student, but the student is upset by it, he said this is his punishment. He spends his day in Golus, wandering from place to place in search of money. That's how he looked at the world. There's no doubt that the Alter was one of the two great spiritual influences on Rav Aaron Cutler. And he spent his formative teenage years there. He's only 14 years old, but it did not stop him from being outspoken and sheer, challenging the Rosh Yeshiva Svaros. Amita shel Torah, the truth of Torah, was the most critical objective. So like in his first go-round in the other Slobodka Yeshiva, he was so short that he had to stand on a chair when he wanted to be heard in shir. But his midos and kavod abrios always reflected the Slobodka influence, the Musar from the altar, and the Torah from the Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein. And yet it was not a picnic, obviously. There are constant pressures on the young teenager, and on others as well, to conform to the norms of Jewish youth of that time. So as we discussed the altar a number of months ago, he long had the controversial practice of censoring the male of his young disciples in order to preclude the harmful influences from home, usually from siblings more than parents. So Aaron Cutler's sister Malka was relentless in trying to convince him to leave Slobodka, enroll in university, and join the modern world. And in fact, he did go back to Minsk on occasion. There are occasions in the yeshiva when Aaron Cutler would repeat to his chaverim some of his sister's communist propaganda. What happened was, the altar then got wise to it, and thereafter never let his sister's letters through. At a certain point, Aaron Cutler found out that his sister's letters were being withheld. Enraged, he packed his bags to leave Slobodka, according to one story, to go to Moscow. There are different interpretations of the story. One is that the altar talked him out of it in the yeshiva. A second version is the altar, Kedarko Bakodesh, told him to get lost, and then he sent a disciple to retrieve him from the train station. Or thirdly, and probably the real story, the altar himself went to the train station to convince him to stay. And he did convince him to stay. Imagine if he had left. How different the Torah world would be if he had left. But we can now understand Rav Aaron Cutler's defining stances in life against college, against secular studies, certainly against the commingling of Torah study and secular studies. And even we'll see later his founding of Chinuch Atzmai in Israel, that there should be no dilution of Talmud Torah, nor any involvement on the part of any secular entity here, the government of Israel, in Torah education. His opposition was relentless, it was implacable, it was consistent, and it was grounded in a personal reality. What did the altar do? He had a young teenager, Aaron Cutler, eat at his Shabbos table more than did most students. And not only because he was a prodigy, but because the altar feared losing him to the other influences, wanted to keep a close eye on him. So he put him under his wing. Later he wrote that he would fast so that Aaron Cutler would be saved. And in fact it worked. He learned in Slobodka for more than 5 years. Then in 1911, he went to learn in Slutsk under the leadership of the great Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, who himself was a Talmud of the altar. And had gone to Slutsk in 1897 when the altar responded to the request of the Ritbaz to open a yeshiva there. Recall again that Slutsk, one of the four towns, the Karpas towns, that had no Hasidim in them, Prussian being one of the others. So he visited Slutsk briefly to try the yeshiva, returned to Slobodka. Rabbi Zalman was so taken with him that he announced that he wanted Rav Aaron Cutler as a son-in-law, as a husband for his daughter, Rivka Chana Perel. He was 19 years old, I think she was 17. When Rav Aaron tarried in returning to Slutsk from Minsk, Rabbi Zalman traveled himself to Slobodka to seal the deal. He was afraid that Rav Aaron would be snatched up by some wealthy father. And he told the altar, Rav Aaron Cutler was a treasure. I mean, he traveled to Slobodka back to find him. He told the altar, Rav Aaron Cutler was a treasure, and they became engaged, and for a few months corresponded. He in Slobodka, she still in Slutsk with her father, only started to learn there after they married. Here, of course, controversy intrudes. Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, in the Making of a Gadol, about his father, Rav Yaakov, recorded in the first edition a number of things that ticked off the Cutler family. And so the book was banned before it was reissued in what was called Mahadra Mutukenet, an improved version. So among the things they objected to, apparently, was the assertion, I guess Rabbi Yaakov reported it, that the Rav Aaron Cutler wrote romantic letters to his fiancée while they were engaged. Again, he in Slobodka, she in Slutsk. Something that apparently to the family detracted from his greatness, as it made him human. It's a strange way of looking at the world. But he does record that Rav Aaron Cutler sent another letter to his bride, to which Rav Isser Zalman objected. This is in the improved version. Apparently, he sent her the notes of a very impressive shir that he had given in Slobodka. And Rav Isser Zalman complained to the altar about the boy that he had sent him. And the altar said, "Kedarko, I told you he was a Talmud Chacham. I never told you he was a tzaddik." But the altar continued, "His frumkeit will yet be so great that everyone will suffer its brunt." And indeed, it's incontrovertible that Rav Aaron Cutler was not only a gaon, he was also a tremendous tzaddik as well. So you remember I said that his father was Shneur Zalman Pinnis. It was Rav Isser Zalman who changed his name from Pinnis to Cutler for the grandest of Jewish reasons, in order to avoid conscription into the Tsar's army. They took a name of a family that only had one son, meaning the first son would be the second son would be drafted, not the first. So a lot of families had four sons with four different last names, pretending that they're each the first. That's how he got the name Cutler. And then he married. He began learning in Slutsk, where some of the Talmidim were extraordinary. At the same time, he was there. Rav Moshe Feinstein was there. Rav Yosef Elio Henkin was there, and others as well. Rav Aaron Cutler was always fiery. In learning, Rav Yaakov said about Rav Aaron Cutler, he always thought he was right. He said once, in an argument in Shir, Rav Aaron Cutler exclaimed to his father-in-law, Rav Isser Zalman, "I know how to learn better than you." To which Rav Isser Zalman, who was an early disciple of the Alter, responded, "Well, that's not very much." And they went on from there. You know, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky knows, so they played chess. Once there was a teenager, they'd been apart for a few years, and they played chess, and Rabbi Yaakov won. And he said, Rav Aaron Cutler cried for a few hours, must have been 16, 17 years old at the time. He just cried. And Rabbi Yaakov said that it's good mussar. You have to learn that you don't always win and that you're not always right. But he knew, Rav Aaron Cutler knew how to engage in the Milchamta Shel Torah. Soon, very soon, he was 22, Rav Isser Zalman asked Rav Aaron Cutler to give a shir in the yeshiva. He was very young. He never lost that trait, though. Almost 40 years later, in the 50s, early 50s, he went to Israel. He was arguing about something with the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish did not budge. Said Rav Aaron Cutler, "I never met a man as obstinate." All right? He could have been talking about himself, of course, but it's hard to see that. But this single-mindedness that he had was attributed by some as the source of Rav Aaron Cutler's greatness in Torah and in communal leadership. He set goals and he knew how to achieve them. The couple had only two children who survived infancy. One son, Rav Schneur, was born in Slutsk. He was named after Rav Aaron Cutler's father, with the Zalman dropped in deference to the other grandfather. And he, of course, succeeded his father's reshiva in Lakewood. And he had a daughter as well, was born in Kletsk in 1925. Sarah, she married and she got divorced. It's a very fascinating story, but this part of the complications. As the story goes, it's told in a number of forms, but it's basically the story basically the same. Rav Aaron went to give a shir, went to Israel, always gave shir in the yeshivos. He went to the Chevron Yeshiva, and there a young Talmud, Rav Dov Schwartzman, was very argumentative. In fact, even impudent in the way he addressed Rav Aaron Cutler. See, he told me he forgot the whole shir is useless because he forgot an open Mishnah. All right? Rav Aaron Cutler was taken aback and he said, "I want this man as my son-in-law." And in fact, he schlepped him back to America and he became his son-in-law, but the marriage, they had children, all involved in Talmud Torah until today, but the marriage did not last. They eventually divorced. In any event, the yeshiva in Slutsk survived World War I barely, And after the war, harassed by the Bolsheviks, he was even arrested and beaten a few times. Ravissa Zalman and Rav Aaron Cutler moved the yeshiva to Kletsk, which was not far away, but was west enough, just over the border, situated in the newly independent Poland. So it was a very prescient move. He saw a better future then in Kletsk in Poland than in Russia under the communists. And thereafter, he'd be known, Rav Aaron Cutler, as the Kletska Rosh Yeshiva. Even when he was in Lakewood, he was still referred to by people who addressed him as Kletska Rosh Yeshiva. In 1923, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer moved to Israel. He became the Rosh Yeshiva, Etz Chaim Yeshiva, and he straddled both worlds. He was not really like his son-in-law. Both worlds, the yeshivish world, the Mizrahi world. Rav Aaron Cutler became an anti-Zionist. Rav Issa Zalman was enamored with and greatly respectful of Rav Kook. And he numbered among his Talmidim in Etz Chaim Yeshiva. He had a lot of Talmidim, especially in the yeshivish world. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was his Talmud. Rav Gorin was his Talmud. Rav Amital was not only briefly a Talmud, but also married Rav Issa Zalman's granddaughters. In fact, Rav Yehuda Amital was the nephew of Ron Cutler. Rav Issa Zalman was much more patuach than his son-in-law, Rav Aram. In 1927, a new yeshiva building was dedicated in Kletsk, and the yeshiva and Rav Aaron became prominent across Europe. Students flocked to Kletsk. Even from America, they came to learn in Kletsk. His wife, Chana Perel, was the yeshiva secretary, and his fame as a Torah giant spread. And then came the Holocaust. If fear of the Haskalah shaped his attitude toward the world at large, the Holocaust would play as important a role in the last 20 years of his life. And as prescient as he was in knowing when to leave Russia for Poland, he was less so in anticipating the consequences of the Holocaust. He simply did not believe that war would come, and if it did, it would not have the catastrophic impact on Jewish life that it had. Of course, who could predict such a horror except in retrospect? Reputedly, he told his Talmidim not to leave the yeshiva and not to leave Europe, that no harm would befall them. At least in 1939. A young Talmud, 1939, Rav Gedalia Shor, then just Gedalia Shor, later Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, who was an American citizen, his family had immigrated in the early 1920s, he went with his wife to learn in Kletsk in 1938. In fact, his wife apparently taught English to Sara Cutler, the daughter. In the summer of 1939, with the storm clouds brewing over Europe, he got a letter from his parents ordering him, Gedalia Shor, to go home. Rav Gedalia sent a letter to Rav Aaron Cutler asking what should he do, stay or go. Rav Aaron then was vacationing Ben Azmanim. He wrote him back and told him not to leave, to stay, that the war would not affect them. By the time the letter had arrived in Kletsk, Rav Gedalia Shor was already on a ship back to the United States. So he never got the letter. Of course, he was saved. Right after the start of the war, yeshiva was evacuated to Vilna, arriving on Shabbos, Pikuach Nefesh. Rav Aaron continued to give shiurim as he struggled to keep the yeshiva together, to find visas and escapes for everybody. At the time, he had about 250 students. He himself declined a certificate to leave with his wife and son for Israel. He relocated to Saluk, but the pressures continued to mount, and the Soviets soon took over Lithuania. Remember, it was independent between the wars, making life even more precarious. During the Holocaust, many of his students were murdered. Rav Aaron Cutler was arrested by the NKVD on November 8, 1940. He was interrogated and released, and finally he was saved through the intervention, the special intervention of the newly formed Vad Hatzalah in New York, along with other Rosh Yeshiva, like Rav Avram Kalmanovich, Rav Zalman Sarotsky, Rav Blaise Yehuda Finkel, Rav Ruben Grzovsky, and others as well. And they all escaped January-February 1941, heading east with hundreds of others to the sanctuary of Japan, and with his wife and his daughter. His son, Rav Schneier, had been arrested in Russia for avoiding the draft. And when he was released, somehow he made his way to Israel, where he learned with, among others, his grandfather, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. In Japan, briefly, Rav Aaron Cutler was once severely beaten by Japanese police for not bowing when the emperor passed by in the street. He was that tough. There's a famous story, oft repeated, but whose accuracy cannot be vouched for. And the truth is, I don't really accept it as true, but it's a good story. Rav Aaron Cutler was debating where to go, America or Israel. So as the story goes, he did the Goral Hagra, meaning opening up the Tanakh randomly to a pasuk to seek guidance. He opened, and as the story goes, the pasuk came up in Parsha Shmos, Vayomer Hashem El Aharon, meaning him, Lech Likras Moshe Hamidbara, go forth to greet Moshe in the wilderness, or Moshe meaning Moshe Feinstein in America. The truth is, I'm not sure what his options were in any event. I'm not sure how close a relation we had with Moshe before the war, although I can understand the later attempts to link them together. In any event, he sailed east on a Japanese ship, arrived in San Francisco right before Pesach, April 10th, 1941. He headed east to New York on the first day of Chol HaMoed, train ride, long trip, came to New York City on April 21st and announced, I quote, in Yiddish, he never really spoke English that much, "I did not come to this country to save myself. I came so that with your help, we could save our brethren in the centers of Torah learning. Only you, the Yidden of America, are able to help them. Do it now, save them." And he became the tireless activist for the Vahd Hatzalah, traveling, raising money, sending money in packages to Jews in war-ravaged Europe, acquiring visas to Israel and America, by hook or by crook, skirting the law when necessary. He was able to unite all the Orthodox groups under the Vahd Hatzalah banner. And he became one of the three main forces behind the Vahd Hatzalah. One other we've discussed, Reb Elazar Silver, and also Rav Aaron Kalmanovich, who had been freed with him, who was the mirror Rosh Yeshiva. Assisting him in all his endeavors for almost the entire two decades of Aaron Cutler's life in America was the noted Askon Irving Bunim, who I had the privilege of meeting one time. I have to thank him. He took me out for dinner. I was with his grandson. Delicious dinner till today, filet mignon. There were powerful obstacles, especially American government indifference and or hostility. You know, more and more it's coming out these days, how Roosevelt just really turned the blind eye to the Jews. We always knew it, but now the documents are being published. He didn't care for the niceties which the Jewish establishment groups obeyed. The Vahd Hatzalah would stop at nothing. They would travel and raise money on Shabbos. Many stories. Rav Aaron, Mr. Bunim, and others would pull up in a cab to someone's home on Shabbos. Write me a check. Give me cash. We need the money. They changed early on from relief efforts to rescue efforts. And they finally, it was a meeting at which Rav Aaron Cutler participated, they attracted the involvement of the Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, who was moderately helpful in intervening with Franklin Roosevelt. Rav Aaron Cutler was zealous in his desire to save Jews. He insisted that rescue workers be free of any yetzera, that they care deeply about every Jew. And he said, if you're not sensitive to the plight of one soul, you will not have compassion for the plight of the many. And here's another Dvar Torah that he said, it's on the Medrash we have in number 3 in Shmos Rabbah. God always tested the ancients with the tzon to see how they cared for sheep. So the Medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was roh tzono shel Yisrael by Midbar, he was shepherding Yisrael's flock, one kid ran off. And Moshe Rabbeinu ran after the kid to bring him back. And then he saw the kid stoop at a brook to drink water. And Rav Moshe said, he said, Omar, ani lo ha'isi yodeh sheratz ha'isi b'mnei tzamei. I only thought you were running because you were tired. But oyei fata, now I'm sorry, because you were thirsty. But now I see you're tired as well. Moshe took the kid, put it on his shoulders, and they walked back. Omar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Yesh Lecha Rachamim Lehog Tzoro Shel Basu V'dom. Kach Hayecha Totir Etzoni Yisrael. This is how the compassion that you have for creatures of flesh and blood, sheep, by your life, you will shepherd my sheep as well. Hoy u'Moshe hoya ro'eh. Moshe was the shepherd. That's how he saw himself. That is what he encouraged others to do. He was so zealous that he expended resources if there was even a chance that some Jew might be saved. He did not succumb to the FDR line that most secular Jewish leaders were peddling, that the best way to help the Jews of Europe was to help the war effort. He knew, as others did as well, that if that were the case, by the time the war would be won, it would be too late for most Jews. Rav Aaron Cutler said famously, "I would bow down to the Pope if it would save the fingernail of one Jewish child." But there are few like him, and even the Varatzala could save only thousands while millions were being murdered, and the kind words of politicians were rarely translated into action. Unlike others, Rav Aaron Cutler never trusted FDR. And he would make calls constantly. He had a direct way about him. He would make a phone call to someone, and he would just say, "Das ist Cutler." Years later, he raised money for Lakewood, he would say, "Das ist Cutler von Lakewood." And that was his introduction. No titles, get right to the tachlis. And he worked with anyone. This seemingly too incredible to be true story actually took place, unlike the other one. During World War II, at one time, 24 rabbinical students being held in Italy, and they faced being deported to Nazi-occupied Europe and certain death. So Ron Cutler turned to Irving Bunim and asked who could intercede on behalf of these 24 young rabbis, and Mr. Bunim suggested that they get in touch with the mafia. So Rav Aaron Cutler urged Bunim to contact them immediately. Well, as the story goes, he asked the Rav Aaron and Mr. Bunim, "Who's going to the meeting?" And Rav Aaron said, "Me and you." They went and they met with Joe Bonanno, or head of the Bonanno crime family, known affectionately as Joe Bananas. Rav Aaron didn't speak English, so it was up to Mr. Bunim to explain the problem of the 24 Rabbanim trapped in Italy. Joe Bonanno asked Mr. Bunim, "Who is the elderly man sitting next to you?" And Irving Bunim said, "He's the godfather of the Jewish people." All right? So Joe Bonanno said, "Really?" And Mr. Bunim said, "Yes, yes. Tell him I want a blessing." Mr. Bunim turned to Rav Aaron and said to him in Yiddish, "Evil a bracha from the Rav." He wants a bracha from the Rav. So Rav Aaron Cutler turned to Joe Bonanno and said, "Zogemer zolai bin lang und starben in bet." Tell him, "Rabbi blesses you with a long life and you should die in bed." And Joe Bonanno said, "I like that." And in fact, he promised within 2 weeks to arrange the freedom of the 24 Tamir Chacham stuck in Italy, which indeed he did accomplish. And Joe Bonanno lived to be 97 years old, and unlike many mafioso, he died in bed. Rav Aaron Cutler continued this work even after the war, even traveling to Europe in late 1945 to see what help he could bring, soon after he brought his sister back. In the middle of all this, he decided to revolutionize Torah in America. His opposition to college was unyielding. Now, he had come to America first in 1935 to fundraise. And when he came, Rav Revel, who was the Rosh Yeshiva and president of Reitz, invited him, like he did all the European Rosh Yeshiva, to give a shiur at YU. It wasn't YU, it was Yeshiva College. Rav Aaron Cutler was hesitant. So opposed was he to secular studies in any form that he consulted Rav Henkin, who was his classmate in Slutsk, who assured him that YU was a yeshiva like any other yeshiva, except that in America they need to study secular subjects as well. He went and gave the shiur, but in the ensuing years he adopted the implacable opposition to YU of Rav Yochanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo. So after his return to America, he never once set foot in YU. Never once. That's how opposed he was. One time, 1958, as the story is told, he remained outside Reitz during the funeral of Rav Moshe Shatzkis, who whom he'd also known from Europe, the Lomjarov, because he did not want to enter the building. A car drove up, and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky emerged, and their eyes caught each other. And Rav Aaron was looking at him, testing him, to see if Rabbi Yaakov would enter the building. It was an overcast day. Rabbi Yaakov stepped back, Zechacham. He placed his palms up as if it was raining. Then he said to the driver, "Let's go in as if we'll avoid the rain." So he entered. Rabbi Aaron stayed outside. And in essence, he defined his approach as anti-YU. Secular studies had no place in the yeshiva. And he reportedly said, this I heard years ago, that anyone with a PhD is disqualified from paskening a shaila. His mind is already too filled with non-Torah thoughts. YU was YU, but three times he put the kibosh on the plans of other yeshivos to formalize a secular studies program. For example, he banned Ner Yisrael from establishing a night program with Loyola. They later did after he died, but I tell you, to this day they deny it exists. He banned Torah Vadas and Yeshivas Ruchaim Berlin from opening their own secular studies division in the 1940s. They wanted a YU sort of program for themselves. And also banned them from formalizing a program with Brooklyn College in the 1950s. How did he do it? Force of personality and personal conviction. Rav Moshe Feinstein said there they had a program, and I guess Rav Moshe was not under his sway. The others were, and they were subservient to him. So how then to navigate the American scene where this was now expected of a young American growing up? He had a vision. He had a dream of establishing a yeshiva where students would learn lishma. No concern for parnasa, no concern for smicha, for the rabbinate, just Torah lishma. In late 1942, he called a meeting of B'nai Torah in the Clymer Street Shul on the Lower East Side. 150 young Bachrim attended. He said the European Torah world is destroyed and we have to rebuild, and we have to rebuild it exactly as it was in Europe. When he announced it, he was mocked by his rabbinical colleagues. One used the line, famous, we're living through this period now, Rabbi Akiva presumed that Bar Kochva was the Mashiach. He was told, Yerushalmi quotes it, by one of his colleagues, "Hair will grow from my palm before the Mashiach comes," he said to Rabbi Akiva. They said to Rav Aaron Cutler, "Hair will grow from my palm." See, the palm has no hair, by the way, for the non-scientists here, the non-doctors. "Hair will grow from my palm before you're successful." Everyone thought he was dreaming. Rav Aaron Cutler, as I mentioned earlier, hoped one day to have 20 Talmidim learning Lishma. But it was that determination, resolve, that countenanced no other opinions that enabled him to see it to fruition. He opened with 13. Today there are thousands. The revolution of Torah study in America, Lishma, was forged by one person, Rav Aaron Cutler. Somehow he restored the crown of Torah to its primacy in Jewish life. And in an environment, Western, materialistic, secular, and strongly biased in favor of higher education, where no one thought it was possible. And obviously it was not easy. Rav Aaron Cutler never lived in Lakewood. He lived in Borough Park. He'd be driven to Lakewood, but he spent much of his time fundraising, so much of his time that the average person would have given up. It was through him, to a great extent, that the legendary prophecy of Reb Chaim Volozhiner was culminated. In the early 1800s, Reb Chaim said that the last bastion of Torah before the Messianic era would be in America. Reb Aaron Cutler made it safe to learn Lishma, to be a public Jew, to be unafraid to articulate the truths of Torah. On some level, he paved the way for the Hasidic world to take root in America as well. In 1900, even in 1940, it was inconceivable there would be in America a Lakewood, a New Square, a Muncie, and probably not even a Teaneck. It could not be envisioned. Beis Medrash Gavoa first opened in White Plains in 1942. Rav Aaron Cutler moved it to Lakewood far from the distractions of New York City, on Irving Bunim's recommendation, in 1943, and a supporter donated a building to use. When he gave shir again, it was just like in Kletsk, fiery, Yiddish, genius, hard to follow, little tolerance for interruptions, like just like it was in Kletsk. A Talmud interrupted, he would yell at him in Yiddish, "You're babbling like a Turk," meaning you're saying nothing comprehensible. And he'd go back to his shir. But he loved the Talmidim. He loved the Talmidim. He was known for sticking a bill into the jacket of a Talmud before a date, reminding him that he has to treat. And he established the high standards for which Lakewood is known. Yet he had to spend so much time traveling around raising money, it was depressing, although he never grew despondent. He held that if people did not appreciate the value of Torah, that was their problem. And if they gave small amounts, that too was a blessing. He loved people who loved Torah. He would go to the funerals of Jews who would not observe it, only because they'd given money to Lakewood, in the hope, the thought, that if the children saw the old man, look how he looked, at the funeral, someone was not observant, only because their father showed Kavanah Torah, maybe they'd show Kavanah Torah as well. Just a few hours ago, I was looking something up, and it's a fascinating story. When he was escaping Russia to go to Japan, at the border, he was carrying a briefcase of his Chidushei Torah. And the border guard said to him, "What's that? State secrets?" So he said, "No, it's commentaries on the Torah." And the guard said to him, "That's shtus. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ludicrous." Reb Aaron got so enraged, he started arguing with the customs agent. And the people with him had to grab him away, lest they take him and send him to the gulag, take him over the border into Japan. He was indebted to anyone who supported Torah education. Again, another day, traveled around, ended with almost nothing. He told the student driver, "Don't tell anyone how little money was raised. No one will want to become a Rosh Yeshiva." He was a purist, and like all purists, he was uncompromising. He became the dominant force for the rejuvenation of European Orthodoxy. If you look at and of course in America as well, he was acknowledged as a gadol. I just quoted as a sample number 4, a very interesting machlokas not yet ended. It's in the Mishnas Rabbi Aaron Siman Mem Zayin. It's something he sent to Yosef Elio Henkin. Remember, I think we discussed it a month or two ago, the great machlokas of Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Yosef Elio Henkin on the efficacy in halacha of a civil marriage, all right? Two Jews marry, city hall, no chuppah v'kiddushin. You need a get or not. So Rav Moshe Feinstein held that you don't need a get because they're not married, halacha. There's no chuppah v'kiddushin, and you don't say ein adam osa bilasa bilas znus in a promiscuous society. Rav Henkin disagreed, and Rav Aaron Cutler here agreed with Rav Henkin against Rav Moshe that they need a get because they see themselves as married. And you're right, if ein adam osa bilas bilas znus, in fact they're married, they see themselves as married, and therefore they require a get. But he was mixed in everything. But the purist does keep the more moderate elements in check, it's true, but there's a downside as well. And by this I mean that who knows what would have happened to the modern Orthodox world if it didn't have this pull coming from Lakewood. Who knows what would happen? It could be even worse. But the downside of it is you leave your followers less able to negotiate the American scene. Meaning if you deprive your students of higher education for many years and they start raising large families and they have no noticeable means of parnasa, so it's no big shock why Lakewood has had its share of scandals, trickim, shtickim, that people used to get by, very often involving government money. Of course, it's not limited to them. It happens elsewhere as well. In the early 1960s, Rav Aaron became the major Jewish leader to support federal aid to public schools at a time when even the OU, I'm sorry, to private schools, at a time when even the OU and the RCA were against it, and certainly the establishment secular organizations were against it on bogus church-state grounds. But in fact, the law was passed in 65 after he died, but Avraham was right, and even the other Orthodox organizations came to see it his way, ad hayom, not the secular organizations. He just perceived the injustice of Jews being forced by the government to teach secular studies, but not benefiting from any of the taxes that we pay towards education. So it goes without saying, though, that the lack of higher education usually correlates to a lower income, and having the government pay meant that Jews had to pay less. You want to define the distinction between YU and Lakewood in a nutshell, it would be that YU is Torah Umada, and Lakewood is Torah Lishma, and therein lies a big difference. And when it comes to college, so look, we have our own opinion, but frankly, who's to say that he's wrong? The fact is, in his day, the big fear was apikorsis. So that's still a fear on some level, but the greater fear today is immorality. It's moral relativity. It's the values that are taught there. So you go to college, especially secular college, too many dropouts than we care to acknowledge. It still happens. So who's to say he's wrong? On the other hand, who's to say that he's right? Because to deprive Jews en masse of higher education means that you're relying on who? As your doctor, as your lawyer, as your accountant, etc. So it's a complicated area, and I say not just to split the difference, but I'm glad that both opinions exist, because each one serves as a check on the other. Despite the purism, he was a powerhouse on the American scene in a number of organizations. He headed the Gudas Rabbanim, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah Agudas Yisrael, Torah Umesorah, and of course Chinuch Atzmai. So he opposed the state school system in Israel and started this organization that would sustain hundreds of independent schools free of government money and therefore interference. And again, it's a mixed blessing, because you see today, what are they really teaching? There are places in Israel, after the fourth grade, they don't teach math. They never teach English, so the kids are handicapped their entire lives. Now, obviously, Chinuch Atzmai was controversial, because it directly challenged the legitimacy of the Israeli government educational system, and even the religious Jews who ran the Mamlachti Dati system. Occasionally, his Lakewood board complained that money he raised for Chinuch Atzmai was money he was not raising for his own yeshiva. And he told them, what should I do? But the education of 40,000 children in Eretz Yisrael is more important than my own yeshiva. Let the yeshiva suffer, so long as thereby Jewish children will at least know the Aleph Bez. I understand where he's coming from. Of course, the Jewish children in Israel learn the Aleph Beis, even if they're secular, but nonetheless, even the Mamlachti Dati system was insufficient. Look, he was an outright anti-Zionist, and like others of his background, he saw Zionism in the light of the Haskalah and was suspicious of anything that did not emanate from a Torah source. He was utterly opposed to the denominations in Jewish life. It was unthinkable. And he spearheaded the letter of the 11 Rosh Yeshiva in 1956 that banned Orthodox participation in mixed synagogue boards and on the Synagogue Council of America. In fact, the question came from him, and he prohibited it. You have it in number 5, the statement that was made, banning participations in these boards, forbidden by law of our sacred Torah, with all the names of the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva who signed, Rav Aaron Cutler, Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Hutner, Rav Rudeman, Rav Shor, from Reitz even, Rav David Lifshitz, Mendel Zaks. The RCA world was in a furor. Famously, Rav Salvechik did not sign, but publicly he remained silent. He didn't support it, out of deference to Rav Aaron Cutler, whom he respected, but he didn't oppose it so as not to run afoul of what the RCA wanted. And the RCA used his silence as acquiescence to continue these relationships with the non-Orthodox rabbinate. Less well-known, but equally striking, Reb Lezer Silver also didn't sign. He didn't believe in these frontal attacks, but he'd already been supplanted as the real head of the Gudas Rabbanim world. Reb Aaron was adamant that this ban applied only to organizations, but not to Jews of whatever stripe. Every Jew is precious. And you see, Lake was really one of the catalysts for the Kirov movement in America until today. I would say majority of the Kirov movement, I shouldn't say because Chabad probably surpassed them, but until Chabad, the non-Hasidic Kirov movement is largely Lakewood, with all due respect to NCSY. Every Jew was precious, and he considered those who were outside essentially Tinoko Shinishbu, but he laid down a marker, and he was the first one to do this. There are no streams. There are no denominations in Judaism. There's only Torah. And he initiated the process of having the establishment Orthodox overcome what essentially was an inferiority complex. Until his time, the Orthodox was always fighting a holding battle on the defensive. He went on the offensive. He popularized the notion of the kollel in America. It was unthinkable before his time. In retrospect, the Synagogue Council of America was useless anyway. And when it died 30 years later, no one much cared. And the non-Orthodox by then were straying so far from the fold. Patrilineal descent, female clergy, etc. Orthodoxy could never have begun its resurgence in America without Rav Aaron Cutler's leadership and determination. He had ideological enemies. He could be caustic when dealing with heretics. And yet these hashkafic differences never affected his personal relationships with people. The Rav greatly admired him, looked up to him, consulted him on halachic questions, and each showed the other great respect. Rav Aaron Cutler famously invited the Rav to give the keynote address at the inaugural banquet of Chinuch Atzmai, which is not a natural choice because the Rav was the head of Mizrahi then. And Chinuch Atzmai was the independent school system that defied Mizrahi and the Israeli government. But the Rav went, so I just heard last month, you can get it on YouTube now, the whole speech, spoke about 20 minutes in Yiddish, English translation for those who are hard of Yiddish. The Rav spoke memorably about Torah education, and when at one point he referred to Rav Aaron Cutler as the Gadol Hador, a throwback to the Beis Halevi and the Chassam Sofer, Rav Aaron started to cry. You could hear it on the tape. And he grabbed the Rav's sleeve. He was to his right. And he tugged at it. And he said, "Das ist nicht Emes. Das ist nicht Emes. He's not the Gadol Hador." He was single-minded. He was strong-willed. But he acknowledged the views of others. The Rav, Reb Eliezer Silver, with whom he did not always agree, and as strange as it sounds, he was a moderating influence on some of his Tamidim, who always wanted to pull up the planks and sail their own way. That would happen to a great extent in the decades after his passing. So you have this anomaly that Lakewood essentially is a separatist community, even from the rest of the Orthodox world, and yet it's heavily involved in Kirov, in the Jewish world. And he always retained his midos. I mean, the stories are legion. Irving Buna once came to his home and saw him playing chess. It was a weekday afternoon. And he was astounded because Rav Aaron never wasted a minute. When the other player left, an older man, Rav Aaron explained to Mr. Bunim that this fellow had lost his entire family in the Holocaust and is broken. No one can reach him. So we play chess, and I talk to him gently. Chess is the only way to reach him. And eventually the man remarried and built another family. He would go anywhere for Chinuch Atzmai. He once spoke at a Mizrahi assemblage, hostile territory. For Chinuch Atzmai, a speaker began to berate him. I'm sorry, someone in the audience began to heckle. When his Talmidim arose to intervene, Rav Aaron Cutler silenced them and said, "Let him speak. Perhaps he's right." But there are few who would give him Musar. And he attracted devoted lay people as Asganim. Irving Buerm I mentioned, later Marvin Schick for a number of years, and others as well. During the 1953 battle over Gius Banot, the draft of girls into the Israeli army, Irvan Cutler reached out to the Rav, hoping that he would come out publicly against Ben-Gurion's decree. It was a bracha latal, because the Rav never opposed Mizrahi publicly. They had a meeting at Rav Mendel Zaks's apartment in Washington Heights, and it was interesting reading about it. They called each other always by titles. Rav Zaks was the Radner Rosh Yeshiva, the Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law. Rav Aaron was the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rav was known as the Boston Rav. After more than a half hour of a futile effort to get Rav Soloveitchik to publicly oppose Gius Banot, Rav Aaron Cutler said, "Boston Rav." Imagine that instead of the three of us discussing this issue, there are another three who are judging whether this is appropriate to draft girls into the army. Instead of you, Boston Rav, there's your Gzeder Reb Chaim. Instead of the Radner Rosh Yeshiva, there's your father, the Chafetz Chaim. Instead of me, there's my father, Rebbe Zalman Meltzer. Boston Rav, what would your Zeder have said? The Rav was unimpressed. He got up, said he had to leave. Kletzka Rosh Yeshiva, Radner Rosh Yeshiva, a guten tug. And he got up and left. He didn't want to publicly oppose Mizrahi. But he also felt, I assume, that decisions are made now, not 50 years ago. So what Reb Chaim would have said in Brisk in 1900 is not as relevant to what should happen in the Jewish state in 1953. The Rav saw that. Rav Aaron Cutler really didn't see that. He tried to transplant Europe into America, and that was his great strength. It was also a weakness, because the opposition to college left Lakewood dependent, in large part, on government money for its subsistence, and other handouts as well, and in some isolated cases, chicanery. But the YU world was much more discreet as Jews, trying to find a comfortable middle ground between being Jewish and being American, the Ger Vitoshev paradox of the Rav. Rav Aaron did not seek a middle ground at all. He had only one turf, and that was the world of Torah. You could take it home. I copied on the flip side a speech he made at the RCA convention in 1955, parts of it. You would ask why he spoke at the RCA convention, of all places, because at the time, Rabbi David Hollander, Zichron Levracha, was the president. I was right in the middle of this business with the mixed rabbinic boards, etc. Rabbi Hollander was a big right winger. I respect him tremendously. I had a nice relationship with him. So he brought him in to try to give a little chizuk to his wavering colleagues. If you read it, you see how strong he is. Six, the essence is, you have to decide what camp you're in. It's not just a question of observing mitzvahs. What camp? Look at number seven, and you see the greatness and the problem. And if one is forced by circumstances to be engaged in earning a livelihood, even that will be considered an act for the sake of Torah, provided that he sets aside as much time as possible for the study of Torah. So I ask you, where do we find in Jewish literature the notion that a person is forced by circumstances to work for a living? That's Ma'isim B'chol Yom. That's Yofet Tamator Melacha. Shkiyashne Mishkach HaSavon. After the Holocaust, he did not see it that way. He saw Torah is Torah, and somehow God will provide, or a father-in-law. And if you look at number eight as well, eight or nine, as for those who oppose any protest demonstrations, their silence constitutes total agreement with the enemies of Torah. If you want to stand up for Torah, you have to ruffle some feathers as well. And you'll read it, you'll see his strength, his power, his uncompromising nature. Not to be lost, his forceful involvement in public affairs led to the rise of Das Torah in the Haredi world that heretofore did not exist in America, and arguably not even in Egypt. The notion that a Gadol's pronouncements on public policy issues carry the same weight as Psak. That too was revolutionary in American Jewish life. And it really paved the way for the Haredi or Yeshivish world to become the dominant force in Orthodoxy today, with numbers that far exceed the modern Orthodox world. Last I heard, 70% of Orthodoxy is Haredi or Yeshivish, 30% is modern. Just to summarize his main accomplishment, if his predecessors toiled to bring American Jews to the love and observance of mitzvos, he labored his entire life to bring them to love of Torah, to prioritize the Torah, to see Torah study as the primary objective and defining characteristic of the Jew's life. He brought the idea of Torah Lishma to an environment that was not fertile and not very open to it, but he opened it, and he tilled the soil, and he changed the complexion of American Jewry. As he once told Irving Buna, a very interesting insight, he said the first immigrants to America, 1700s, were Sfaradim, who built beautiful shuls. They came with the value of avoda, tefillah, avoda. But those shuls soon stood empty. In the 1800s, German Jews came. And they were not into the shuls as much, but they built institutions of chesed as they completely abandoned mitzvos. So avoda is great, and gemilas chasadim are great. Pillars, as we say in Avos. But what sustains the Jewish world is Torah. That emphasis on Torah is what revived Orthodoxy and confounded the non-Orthodox. Many of his writings are found in Mishnas Rebbe Aaron, other compilations. When he died November 29, 1962, age 70, tens of thousands attended his funeral in New York and then in Israel's Beit HaMikdash. His son succeeded him in Lakewood, and his grandsons and great-grandsons spread across the country and the world. He brought Orthodoxy to life in a very real way. He engaged for the first time the battle for Torah against the non-Orthodox. He popularized Das Torah, for good and for bad. If there's one person who could be said to have resurrected the Torah after the Holocaust, especially in America, it is Rav Aaron Cutler. Yehi zichro baruch. I thank you all very much.